Again, after listening to, I'm not working for any company either. So, but after listening to David and Tom, if you guys talk to resume, I have the resume ready for you this afternoon. Because of the thing that I guess you already discussed, and I will highlight it here. Essentially, just reinforce some of the points that have been shown so far at this meeting. And the task that I will ask is just basically try to highlight some of the progress really been exciting over the last, I think David said it, I would say the last 5-6 years have been pretty exciting in this area. Let's see if I can advance this. Okay. Well, first of all, we have a lot of detail here. I think we all know that. I think that the previous talk kind of point out that we are facing with more food production that we require on the less amount of water, and also at the same time we seem to have more incident of drought and to be predicted in the future. So unless we do something about improving drought tolerance and food production, you know, the work may come to an end. And so let's do something about it, I guess. Probably go back to the decade of the 60s. I'm sure that many of you in this room remember the couple classical textbooks by Levitt. At the time when I think we begin to try to understand the physiological of drought adaptation. And of course, it's very complex, and this is still a very classical concept of drought escape and drought tolerance, avoidance, dehydration tolerance. But nevertheless, it's been a very good working concept, and I think it allowed us to understand how plants adapt to stress conditions over the years. And of course, for a long time, we, you know, recognize that drought is very complex, and it's just difficult to genetic improvement, and so it's been a long journey, and along the way, I guess we begin to recognize more and more by people in plant breeding, obviously starting out with physiologists, and we get more people engaged in agronomy and plant breeding, and of course the concept of yield component framework, but I think it does go back to some of the work by John Passiora and the group like Neil Turner in Australia, that basically to remind us that, you know, drought tolerance per se not really the solution. We got to look at the productivity, and those are the concepts that I think David very nicely lay out, and I'm sure that teaming around with Mark Cooper and everybody in the Pioneer. So I think we need to recognize that improving drought tolerance, we need to also be mindful about. I don't see the move there. And I was fortunate to be involved pretty early on, back in the early 90s, when the Rockefeller Foundation program started the program on rice biotechnology, and pretty much interested in improving drought tolerance in rice. And of course, at that time, if you look back at the 1990s, when you talking about improving, you know, using biotechnology to improve drought and rice, it's really a very significant attempt. And of course, we try to go back to the own physiology and try to understanding what really important the target traits, whether the root development, and of course, you have to look at different type of stress environment. And of course, ever since I took the new position in Missouri a few years ago now, we obviously started looking into soybean in terms of some a similar type of work, and try to characterize the root system in soybean, for example, because the root is going to be one of the key traits that will play important role. So I'm just trying to highlight the thing that we, root penetration is another type of trait that been recognized important in rice. And subsequently been some work in wheat and some other species, because in many, many cases we might be dealing with a shallow type of soil. You might have water available underneath the soil profile, but you're dealing with the compacted layer of soil that the root got to have that capacity to penetrate through that compaction. So again, it's just an illustration that it's just not simply just root development per se, but root penetration through a physical barrier also an important component. And then root plasticity, some of the work in Common Bean, some classical work here. But again, it showed that it's important to link what might be going on in root development and plasticity under different type of soil and stress condition. And also been illustrated in sorghum by a good friend of mine, Abraham Bloom, over the years, and the stay green trait, been long recognized by Daryl Rose now, back at Texas A&M when I worked with him there for a number of years. So the stay green is truly an adaptive trait for sorghum. You pretty much need to have stay green to have any kind of drought tolerant in sorghum under the crop production system. So the breeder obviously been recognized for a lot of those things over the years. And of course, you just heard the last talk on stay green. I think in a way, just to delay senescence. And of course, you can look at the whole host of genome blasts that David and show that I have several tables like this, and I basically remove them for the context of 20-minute talk. But you can go in and begin to classify all kind of genes that involve in, you know, water productivity, if you will, number of, you know, water use, water uptake, water control. You can make all kind of table these days about, you know, different transcription factor that could regulate stress response and post-transitional factor, and several, you know, osmoprotectant, biochemical metabolism, molecular chaperoning, and you just hear an example of that, CSPB gene that Tom talked about, and it's obviously been published in Plant Physiology. So I'm just trying to see what's been publishing and what's been the progress and so forth and so on. But how would you trace back to this type of work in the context of drought tolerance? This report back in 2005 by the Performance Plan Group in Canada, dealing with again the concept of genetic down regulation of this specific gene that essentially involved in ABA sensitivity and stomato regulation. And again, a lot of things been published. But what the significance of this work is basically it showed that we could regulate stomatal conductance. We can reduce transpiration rate a bit, but it doesn't really affect much of the productivity. So this is a way to regulate the water loss. Some of the way that we could maximize the productivity under water limiting condition. Of course, for a number of years, we know that there are certainly tight coupling between stomatal conductance and photosynthesis. So it's a balancing act. We can, of course, when it comes to balancing act under the very, very diverse condition of different type of drought, it's not an easy thing. But nevertheless, this shows that conceptually, yes, we can make this thing happening at the field level if we have the right kind of gene and regulation of the water loss. And of course, that brings up the next point in this business. You pretty much not only, and if you notice the initial work, the 2005, they basically used 35S promoter. But obviously that's not going to be the solution in the long run. You need to basically control the promoter, control the regulation. Again, I think the speaker from Monsanto and Pioneer pretty much point those things out very elegantly. So the only area of optimization of the gene construct and promoter and so forth and so on. And this is what this group also tried to do, and this again published subsequently in 2009 when they basically tried to optimize some of that gene construct. Again, I just use this to illustrate the point that in this type of work that's important. This is what you can gather from the website of this company. Again, I don't have any stock anything in this company either. I'm just trying to give a spectrum of what else going on beside the so-called big companies, Monsanto and Pioneer. There are other companies also working on this as well as some public institution. But they basically, try to develop a, certainly, you know, crop plan that will have better drought tolerance using this type of technology. And we did some of this work in rice. This is some of the work that I carry, continue on rice. In a way, kept independently, we actually have the maize squalene synthase gene that we basically utilize, and in the way that it's the now regulation. But it also affecting that fenacyl transferase pathway, it has all to do with that ABA sensitivity. And this is the this is not in the field. This is in the last part type of study. And again, it just published, so you can find the paper in the Journal of Experimental Botany. It should be online right now. And so, but it supports the overall concept of and again, this is the illustration of now. If you now regulate certain key gene, it can lead to, you know, the similar response that you've seen earlier, and that is the we basically can see the delay wilting, slight reduction in stomatal conductance, but it doesn't affect productivity. The plant look normal, there's no difference in morphology, anything that we can detect between wild type and transgenic, a number of different events, independent events, and everything else. So you can see a little bit of reduction in stomatal conductance, but it doesn't affect plant growth and development. In fact, it helped the plant to conserve the water and subsequently better recovery and better grain yield under drought condition. So again, it's just another illustration of if we regulate water loss, it could be the way to conserve the water. At the same time, we can get the plant become more drought tolerant in terms of grain yield. So again, it does go back to that yield framework that maximize water use efficiency and grain yield at the end. And so I guess for something like this, particularly in the rice, there are much scope and latitude for perhaps if we can figure the way for a species like rice, for example. Suddenly use much less water and still able to achieve the same or keep even higher productivity. And so I think that certain. This is the work out of China. One of the transcription factors in rice. And again, it field tested. And I think it showed very promising result. But I think the story seemed to be consistent here too. Totally independent type of gene here, a different condition. But when obviously they achieve higher grain yield under drought condition. And when they look at the mechanism in this specific study, there didn't seem to be any root difference. And it does go down to a little bit of stomatal closure, slow down the water loss, a little bit of transpiration rate. But at the same time, you look at the data they show, it did not affect photosynthesis or any of that. So meaning the plant can basically produce pretty well in terms of yield. And under drought condition, it's just a way to have more, basically use less water, able to use less water. And again, just a little close up for this work, it's been published in 2006, and then obviously the work by Eduardo Plumbock, moving along the timeline here in 2007. I thought it was very exciting, and he talked about this already. This obviously the initial work in tobacco, but subsequently, you have Eduardo, he now has other work going on now, including rice, and he's just talking about it. So I think we continue to hopefully see more field data come out, Eduardo, and I think that will help us to see what really happening at the field level. This is probably one of the events that make all of us excited about the possibility of genetic engineering for drought tolerance. This is the work with one of the transcription factor, that NF YB2 from Monsanto, been published again in 2007 with the field data. And again, it just when they measure the number of related physiological parameters, chlorophyll contents, the stomatal conductance, leaf temperature, wilting, photosynthesis, the story continued to go down that. Basically, we need to have the ability to, maybe stomatic conductance reduce a little bit, but along we can maintain photosynthesis and everything else, we can get the yield. And so again, I think the story that I think maybe they would say certainly is an important point. We're not inhibiting ourselves developing a drought tolerant cactus. It's just simply sit there and not producing. So the plant had to continue to maintain some growth, and even under the difficult water limiting condition, and how to do that successfully. And this is the work which again came out of the cone shock protein in 2008. In May, with the cone shock protein chaperoning type of mechanism, and of course that the other work been published in plant physiology. So I don't want to go into that. But the important thing here I want to point out here, through some collaboration with the project in Africa, we hope we're going to see more field data coming out in the field condition, and hopefully that will be the ultimate test for what really work out in the field. A bit of a highlight in China, you know, similar to the work in Monsanto and Pioneer, they do have this capacity in China. I'm not involved with this project anymore. This is the ongoing of the Rockefeller Foundation program, but now they basically can go through hundreds and thousands of those type of candidate gene and make a lot of construct, do large scale testing in the field. Facility like what you can see here. So this work on rice continue in mostly in China and some other country. And this is some more, you know, promising type of gene that continue to come out, and the testing is ongoing. So I think we're going to see more and more of that work going on in Australia in wheat, testing in the field, more wheat work in China. So we now begin to see a lot of the so-called transgenic type of material that being tested under field condition. And of course the private sector, you heard the story on Pioneer, so I don't need to repeat it here again, and Monsanto. And from what we gather, the commercialization is basically expected to be next year. So I think we, you know, anxiously to see the information coming out and the impact that it will have in terms of crop productivity under more limiting condition. I don't want to forget Syngenta. They also have things that in the market. I did ask them to send in some slide, and they did, and to show that they also have things going on within Syngenta for the number of either transgenic or genomic selection type of product for drought tolerant. Acadia Bioscience and Davis also continue to work on rice and other species. So it's a very, very active research area right now, not only the discovery and academic institution, but also in a number of private sector and international center. So really, truly an exciting time. And, you know, for a year, if you learn physiology years ago, like what I did, you know, drought with, all we know, you know, a complex trait, probably difficult to do in a kind of genetic engineering. But I think that recent progress is showing that, you know, genetic improvement is certainly possible with GM technology. The key thing here are obviously, you know, what specific transcription factor or candidate gene that we could link to key physiological process that leading to the regulation of water use efficiency. And on and on, we need to be worried about gene that somehow control the maintenance of plant water status, photosynthetic activity, and plant growth in order to link that to yield productivity. Certainly, the opportunity and challenge here, clearly that, you know, it's not going to be one thing for everything, so we need to characterize the environment. And again, that's been well stated by the speaker from Monsanto and Pioneer. And of course, the high throughput phenotyping is the bottleneck. And this is truly the concern for many of us in the academic institution. We just don't really at all have anything close to what you've seen today. We can do a lot with different candidate genes that we can explore. Of course, you know, field testing is essential for commercialization. You've seen the managed trial facility, the high throughput phenomics. And clearly that working with different disciplines is very much essential. We don't want to forget about the whole area of genomic selection, combining with plant breeding. Not only the GM technology, but also the whole area of genomic selection is important. So clearly that opportunity abundant now. The question is, you know, how do we make progress in the you look at the global scale. Of course, we're excited about what's going on in Pioneer Monsanto, but like I say, not many of us can afford that kind of facility. And then, so, you know, what does it affect our ability to train future scientists in this area. So the whole host of challenge that we're going through right now and it's still the number game. I think that one thing that I want to impress upon you too would be that, and hopefully you clearly see from the last first two speakers, it is the number game. Still, you got, you know, thousands of genes you can sort it through. You can have some hypothesis testing. You might hit or miss in terms of field performance. So still the number game, but of course, at the end of the day, plant breeding is the number game. So I think that's the challenge that we're facing. Hopefully the basic discovery is to continue in different academic laboratory across the world, and hopefully that will make their way into some commercialization, for the better of mankind. So thank you. Oh, sure. I think again, they are not, you know, one or the other. I think in one hand that, yeah, so for a lot of trade that we know that it's important to adapt to, the difficulty has been would be that we need to pinpoint those genomic location, genomic loci, if you will, and then how to stack them together in the right economic background. So that had to do with that. So yeah, so certainly that's a possibility. And so the knowledge is there. But, you know, how to pinpoint all of the genomic loci is a significant task by itself, because the phenotyping bottleneck for any kind of genetic germline screening, genomic mapping. Yeah, of course, if you can find a number of the loci, certainly you can use the molecular marker breeding technology to accomplish the same thing at the end also. So those processes are not mutually exclusive. On the other hand, you have candidate gene that can, you know, certainly that will have an impact. So I think they're complementary. They're not meant to be, I don't believe, one or another.
So thank you very much. Really appreciate it.